Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Thanks for tuning back in wherever you are. Before we get our guest on the phone today, I'd like to do my Ask Cindy question first out of our usual order. We're mixing things up a little bit today. Jake Terpstra, a supporter of our important work for peace and justice and a big supporter of mine, emailed me with a very loving suggestion last week. Jake said that he has heard me on the, quote, megaphone, end quote, and I am very forceful, but on the radio I sound like an, quote, eager to please, almost shy teenager, end quote. First of all, there's quite a difference between the megaphone and the microphone, but what you hear every week is my regular speaking voice. I have always had a soft and some people say youthful voice. And as a matter of fact, when the parents of my children's friends used to call the house, sometimes they'd refuse to believe that I was the parent. As for being eager to please, the guests that I've had on are people with whom I agree wholeheartedly, and I have them on to give them a soapbox for their views and causes. I guess I could have some member of the robber class on my show, but why would I want to give the robber class another forum for their creepy and greedy ideologies? Today for my soapbox rant, you'll get to hear me on the megaphone giving a speech down in Fresno last weekend, and you'll get to hear the other side that Jake was talking about. Speaking of the robber class, don't forget to order my internet booklet, Myth America, the 10 Greatest Myths of the Robber Class and the Case for Revolution. It's available for a minimum $10 donation to the soapbox. And all you have to do is go to CindySheehanSoapbox.com. You might be there right now. Press donate, give a $10 donation, and I'll send it to your email box. My guest today is a very special friend of mine, Ray McGovern. After we come back, we'll be on the phone with Ray. This is Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan. As always, you can email me at Cindy@CindySheehanSoapbox.com. We'll be right back.
First, they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. If you would like to keep your voice on the air, and you feel this show is important, please contribute now. Go to www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com. That's CindySheehansSoapbox.com. The phone is 562-912-5860. That number again is 562-912-5860. Please help us keep this show on the air. Your generous contribution is appreciated.
You're listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox on the internet only, and I'm Cindy Sheehan, and as I promised before the break, we have a very special show, and we're going to be speaking to a very special friend of mine, Ray McGovern. Ray and I go way back, if you can say like 4 or 5 years is way back, but for me, my entire life has changed since my son was killed in Iraq, and I have a whole new set of friends and a whole new set of activities that I've been doing. I actually sent out an alert today telling my listeners and my supporters that Ray's going to be on my show. And I wanted to find a picture of Ray and I. So I went to Google Images. I put Cindy Sheehan and Ray McGovern, and there were tons of pictures of us together. So we've been doing a lot of work together. But I chose one. I don't know if you saw it, Ray, but I chose one that it's you and I and Joe Wilson, and the photograph is behind John Conyers when he's swearing us in for the Downing Street memo hearings. It was an amazing picture. Anyway, Ray, welcome to my show.
Thank you, Cindy. Really happy to be with you.
Well, I'm really happy that you're with us. So I usually intro my guests and say what they've done and what they're doing now, but I want you to give a little bit of a background on where you came from and what you're doing right now.
Sure. Let's see. You go back to the reign of President John Kennedy. That's when I was lured down to Washington out of my native Bronx, God's country, to try to not ask what my country could do for me, but what I might be able to do for my country. I had majored in Russian undergraduate and had my master's degree in Soviet studies, so it was a kind of natural fit in Army intelligence, where I served 2 years as an infantry and intelligence officer. And then I came on with the CIA as an analyst in the analysis section, and spent the first 5-6 years so homing in on the Soviet Union. Then I was the branch chief of Soviet foreign policy, had a bunch of illustrious folks working under me, including the current Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates. And I had broader responsibilities at CIA, including chairing some national intelligence estimates and also preparing the president's daily brief, which I actually briefed one-on-one during the Reagan presidency. Reagan, he liked to sleep in, so most often we briefed his vice president, another fellow named Bush, the secretaries of state and defense, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and a whole string of national security assistants that came and went, rotated from there to indictments and that kind of thing. So it was good duty, and I'm thoroughly familiar with what's going on there. And after we saw, that is, my friends and I, who are alumni and alumni of the agency, and specifically most of us from the analysis division, and we saw that our profession really was being really corrupted for the express purpose of deceiving our elected representatives out of their constitutional prerogative to declare or otherwise authorize war. I mean,
are we up to the Bush administration and the Iraq war now?
Now we're here. Yeah, and now we're in the end.
The second
of
Bush administration.
2002. Yeah, now we're in the George W. Bush of recent memory. And what we could see in 2002 and early 2003 was that Bush was distorting manufacturing, or as Jay Rockefeller, head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, put it, inventing non-existent intelligence to justify an unnecessary war. We saw that we formed Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity.
And you have a website. Why don't you tell my listeners your website?
Well, I wish we did.
Oh, you don't?
We don't bother with that. We're just kind of always sort of reading and publishing. But most of our stuff appears on consortiumnews.com.
Okay.
And that's a really good website. So we started publishing before the war, warned against it, as others were doing, including Scott Ritter, of course, and others, and had not much publicity other than what we garnered abroad. I got no hearing with the administration, and we're still not getting any hearing, which is really was really disappointing, because the tea leaves say, Cindy, that President Obama is about to make his LBJ Vietnam or George Bush Iraq mistake. We're about to get involved in a real quagmire there. And, you know, it's almost as though there's something in the water here in Washington, Cindy,
right,
because it doesn't make any sense at all. And grown-up people should know that.
Well, that's the topic of our conversation today, is Obama's Vietnam. And before we get into that, because I really want you to tell my listeners why you think Afghanistan will be Obama's Vietnam. But first, before that, I want you to define the Vietnam analogy. But even before we do that, we have to go back to the last administration, I think. And you talked about, I just saw an interview you gave for Real News Network, and you talked about the real purpose for the Bush, Cheney, Gates surge in Iraq, the surge that I believe began in the beginning of 2007. Because I think at the end of 2006, I was arrested in Crawford, Texas, trying to, they were having some kind of meeting between, it was Cheney and Bush and Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice and, you know, all the major war criminals of the Bush administration were up at the ranch. So I think there was about five of us that got arrested trying to cross the barriers. And you've been to Crawford, so you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The barriers to go to the ranch. So we were arrested protesting the surge because we could see the surge was going to be a nightmare. And no matter how much Obama says the surge was successful, or Cheney or Gates, Rumsfeld's out of the picture. I don't even know where he is anymore. However much they say the surge was successful, there was a high price, and it's not so successful if you know what really happened, was it?
No, it's true, Cindy. Most people don't realize that 1,000, at least 1,000 young men and women from our armed forces are dead now,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, dead. And you know what that means better than anybody
yeah.
else.
Yeah.
And thousands wounded, not to mention Iraqis. I mean, you know, Iraqis, last time I checked the Bible, I looked it up. Iraqis are human beings, too. Would you
really?
Believe it? Yeah, they really are.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
So we have to count them, too. So what?
But we don't count them. We can only estimate how many Iraqis have been killed.
That's right. They don't count. That was the attitude. And what we saw with the surge was really bizarre, Cindy. If you think back to the end of 2006, what was clear is that the Iraqi political figures were not taking seriously their duty to get their act together.
Right.
No matter what we said, they always knew, well, Bush promised them, we'll never leave you, right? That's because he never wanted to leave them, okay? What was happening was the place was falling apart, and General Abi Zaid and General Casey, Abi Zaid being the head of CENTCOM, Casey mm-hmm. being the head of the troops there in Iraq,
right.
came back and testified in September before the Senate Armed Services Committee, and what they said was this, thanks very much, but please don't send any more troops, okay? The last thing we need is more troops. Why? Because if we send more troops, those Iraqis will never, never think that they have to get their act together. We don't need more troops. What we need to do is get them to get some religion here, work out their differences so we can leave, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's what everybody was saying. That's what the Hamilton,
Baker-Hamilton
report said. Everybody in their right mind, you know, everybody sane here, which is usually not too many people, but most people in Washington were saying that, you know, we have to sort of acknowledge that. So what did Bush do? Well, he talked to Cheney and Dick said, well, now, Mr. President, you want to lose a war on your watch? You want to tuck tail and go home to Texas and have the whole thing fall in on you? No, we have to reinforce. Can't listen to these other folks. And so they ginned up some folks at the American Enterprise Institute and a general named Keene, and they whipped up this little plan to put in 30,000 troops. 30,000 troops in and around Baghdad would form a screen so that the Shia could ethnically cleanse Baghdad.
Right.
Now, that's big, you know?
Right.
Baghdad used to be equal Sunni Shia. What these guys did, under the protection of U.S. forces, and often with the help of U.S. forces, drive the Sunnis out of Baghdad. We're talking millions of people, Cindy.
Oh,
millions.
No, yeah, I know. I haven't been to Iraq yet, but I've been to Amman, Jordan, speaking with the people who were forced out. If they were lucky to escape with their lives, and if they were lucky to escape the country. But, you know, as you know, that there's millions of refugees in and outside of Iraq right now.
Yeah, some 4.5 million folks out of 27 million when the war began.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you have here is, you know, a really great success. So we calmed down Baghdad, partly by driving the Sunni out and also by building the kind of wall you used to see in Berlin that now we see in the West Bank and also on our southern border, I have to say, having been recently in southern Texas. You know, that kind of wall is a really great thing to bring people together, right? Well, it separated what was left of the Sunni and actually divided that whole city. So that was great. You know, that's really great if you like walls and if you like ethnic cleansing. And then, of course, we gave Petraeus a whole bunch of money, and he gave it out to the Sunnis. Please, here, we give you $300 a month. Just don't fire in our direction.
$10 a day. They were giving, I think it was estimated about 80,000 people $10 a day not attack the U.S.
So now, of course, that dole is run out. And what happens to the Sunni now? Well, we'll just have to see. But the long and short of it is, it was a great success for Cheney and Bush because they could indeed run off into the sunset and say, well, you know, we didn't lose a war. Now the burden is on Obama to see how he'll extricate his troops from Iraq. And, you know, there are all kinds of people dead, including, as I started out to say, over 1,000 U.S. military folks just to prevent what was the inevitable by about a year and a half. That's unconscionable, in my view.
Well, absolutely, of course, in my view also. But now we have a new administration with the same almost identical cast of characters in the Pentagon. And Obama has said that the surge was a success, even though he says the surge was a success and he has called Iraq a dumb war. He has no intentions of bringing all the troops home, at least while he's president. And just like McCain said, we might be there 50, 100 years, as we've been in Germany, Japan, South Korea, all over the planet. We've left troops as this, Praetorian Guard or something all over the world. So the troops aren't coming home from Iraq anytime soon. He may withdraw combat troops, but you know, you and I know that if a troop is in a foreign land that's being occupied, there's a potential of them, every one of them being combat troops. My son wasn't a combat troop. He was a Humvee mechanic, and he was killed 5 days after he got to Iraq in combat. So, you know, this is for my listeners who are young people or who are parents. If a recruiter says that your child or you won't be a combat troop, that's a lie. But anyway, so now they're surging more troops into Afghanistan, and that has never, ever worked. Even if they put in 500,000 troops like the Soviet Union has, the Soviet Union could not subdue Afghanistan. But tell us why you think. Now, first of all, tell us what the analogy is between Afghanistan and Vietnam and Johnson and Obama.
Well, Vietnam, let's take that. What we had in Vietnam was an intensely nationalistic group of people called the Vietnamese. They were nationalists first, and they also happened to be communists.
Right.
Back in the 50s and 60s, everyone was afraid of the communists. People lumped all communists together. They didn't realize that there was a battle royale going between the Russians and the Chinese.
Right.
Nor did they realize that the Vietnamese were very independent. Thank you very much. They would accept whatever tanks or SAM missiles would be given them, but there was no control over what they did. They were hell-bent and determined to free their entire land. They had been deceived out of that after a victory in 1954. People went to Geneva, and we and the French and others, including the Soviets, pressured Ho Chi Minh to, you know, just wait a couple of years and you can have the whole country. Well, that didn't happen, okay? So what happens next? French leave, and the question is, well, you know, should we pick up from the French where they left off? Well, the French were, you know, what they did after World War II, after Vietnam, well, all of Indochina fell. They sent General Leclerc, their war hero, down to Indochina, and they said, General, tell us, please, how many troops it would take to subdue Indochina and win it back for France. He spent a couple months there, and he wired back, Monsieur General, it would take 500,000 troops, and even then we couldn't do it, quote, end quote. Okay?
Uh-huh.
So what happens? the French send 500,000 troops. Yen Bien Phu happens, 1954. They tuck tail and run home. Next up, the Americans. Make a long story short, LBJ, not wanting to lose a war on his watch, sends 532,000 troops. And guess what? they don't prevail, they tuck tail, and they go home. Now, you know, what you're involved in here is an unwinnable situation where 500,000 troops wouldn't do it. Now, in Afghanistan, it's even worse. If you look at that country, you know, if you flattened Afghanistan, I'm making this up, but I think it would be as large as China, okay? look at those mountains.
Yes,
there.
Yes.
And you don't have to be a historian to know that, well, the way I put it when I'm talking about this is, do you know why Alexander the Great was great, Cindy?
Why?
Well, because he tried to get to China through Afghanistan. And as he went into Afghanistan, his troops started getting whittled away by these, you know, these militants, these insurgents, these people that, you know, for some reason didn't want foreign people coming into their country and occupying it. And so he looked at, he sized up the situation, and he was losing troops right and left. And then he looked up at the mountains, and he said to himself, you know, I think I'll just go home. And he did. Okay? That's why he's great.
Yeah.
He sized up his capabilities, looked at those mountains, looked at his troops getting whittled away, and he said, it's just not worth trying to get through China through this land. Okay? Now, after him came the Persians, came the Indians, came the Mongolians, mm-hmm. came the British, came the Russians, and now we're going to go in there and prevail with 100,000 troops. Give me a break.
You know exactly.
You know what's at foot here, and you know it's sort of ironic here to say that Barack Obama has taken the mantle of the white man's burden, you know. But that's what it is, you know.
Right.
It's almost a racist thing, and you know, I go back to Kipling, and let me indulge me with a two stanza poem here, Cindy.
Well, let's take a quick break,
okay.
And then when we come back, we'll get with the Kipling
okay.
poem so we can hear it all without having to rush through it. So you're
okay.
listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm speaking to my friend Ray McGovern, and we'll be right back after this break.
First, they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. If you would like to keep your voice on the air, and you feel this show is important, please contribute now. Go to www.cindysheehanssoapbox.com. That's CindySheehanssoapbox.com. The phone is 562-912-5860. That number again is 562-912-5860. Please help us keep this show on the air. Your generous contribution is appreciated.
Thank you for staying tuned. We're talking to Ray McGovern, and Ray is going to quote us a Kipling poem, as I promised before the break.
Well, it goes this way, Cindy. It is not right for the Christian white to hustle the Asian brown. For the Asian smiles while the Christian riles, and he weareth the Christian down. At the end of the fight lies a tombstone white, with the name of the late deceased, and the epitaph drear, a fool lies here who tried to hustle the East. That's it.
Wow.
You know, trying to hustle these folks.
That pretty much says it all. And, you know, not only, I think that in occupations only have to be about that, right? They only have to be about wearing down the occupier. And,
yeah,
you know, I can't go back in history and think that there was ever an occupation that was successful. But there's another analogy between Afghanistan and Vietnam that you didn't talk about, and that's the Gulf of Tonkin and 9/11.
Yeah. Well, now, the Gulf of Tonkin was, there were two incidents, one on the 2nd and one on the 4th of August, 1964. Now, the first one was real enough. There were some torpedoes fired against U.S. destroyers whom the North Vietnamese thought were supporting guerrilla raids on islands and even some on the mainland of North Vietnam. And the second incident we know was bogus. We knew it at the time. No shots were fired, and yet there were some crazy reports from some hypersensitive sailors out in those ships, and these were twisted by Lyndon Johnson into a casus belli, a reason for war.
Right.
They were served up to the Senate, and Fulbright was at that time. Well, he said he never regretted anything in his life as much as he did this, but he sponsored this resolution, and it became the quasi-juridical foundation for a full-scale war. That was 1964. Only two senators had the guts to vote against that. Gruning from Alaska and Morse from, I guess it was Oregon.
Right. Morris, I want people to look Wayne Morris up. He was pretty amazing person during that time. But then we have 9/11, and 9/11, of course, was a real incident. Everybody saw it happening. And, you know, whether we believe the official story or the 9/11 report, or whether we go all the way the other way and believe that it was an inside job, an inside job, by that I mean it was planned by some shadowy people in the Bush administration or the Pentagon or the CIA or wherever. But they misled our country into invading Afghanistan after 9/11. And so I think that those two incidences are very similar in this Vietnam-Afghanistan analogy. But we talked a little bit about it already, but what do you mean by maybe Afghanistan will be Obama's Vietnam? Because Johnson, his escalation or surge of troops into Vietnam was disastrous for his political career and his presidency.
That's exactly right. Yeah, in early 1968, the election year, there was the countrywide offensive at Tet at the Lunar New Year, and Johnson, and just 2 months later, went on TV and said he wouldn't even run for president because it looked like not only Bobby Kennedy, but others, Eugene McCarthy and others, were much more likely to even win the nomination. So, yeah, what I mean is simply that it's going to be a bloodbath. It's just going to be awful. And we shouldn't put our young people in there. For what? You know, for what? Number one, we can't resupply them with any real confidence.
Right.
You can't get there from here. I mean, literally, all they have to do is blow up two bridges over the Khyber Pass, and you've got to fly stuff in, which you can't really do because there's weather, there's mountains, and so we're going to ask the Russians to help us? Are we going to ask the Iranians to help us? Give me a break.
Right.
You know, I'm an Army officer. I was an Army officer.
Right.
And I would never put my troops at that kind of disadvantage where my supply lines didn't exist or could be easily severed. So that's one thing. And then the whole notion of how you go about waging an insurgency when your very presence in the country is the main reason why more and more people flock to the insurgents. It's, you know, as I said before, Cindy, it's like there is something in the water here in Washington, and Obama is drinking the water. It's awful.
Well, it's basically just greed for power, greed for profit, and, you know, they use our children as their pawns to, they don't care about our children. Our children are going to, like you said, it's going to be a bloodbath. We're going to see coffins come home now that we can see the pictures of the coffins maybe when they get to Dover. But Afghanistan probably was the downfall of the Soviet Union. So maybe we can call Afghanistan Obama's Afghanistan, because the mighty USSR empire, their military empire, crumbled after a decades-long just horrible. I mean, I wasn't that much into the movements for peace or for justice, but I even remember how horrible Afghanistan was for the Soviet Union, and that it could be the downfall of the U.S. empire, which I think would be a good thing, but I would rather have our elected officials stop drinking the water and start reducing the military-industrial empire without having it crumble on the people of Afghanistan or without having it crumble on our soldiers and really on our economy also.
Well, you're absolutely right. It doesn't have to happen. And, you know, if we're talking about 100,000 troops, that's not going to do anything.
Oh, absolutely not.
And even as General Leclerc said, 500,000 is not going to do it. When are we going to get it through our head that we can't work our will on a nationalist folk that don't want to be invaded, don't want to be occupied? And so, you know, we haven't mentioned Pakistan yet.
I was just about to say that, and the Pashtuns and their fiercely tribal nationalistic area. And I was going to ask you about that right now because I saw a report today that, and this woman, I think she was from the New York Times, was saying that now they have proof, and I don't know how good this proof is because I don't trust anybody anymore, that Pakistan is helping the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you say Pakistan, you need to distinguish it's their army that's in bed with the Taliban, at least many elements of their army. You see, they pretty much created the Taliban, and they see the Taliban as kind of an insurance. They know, that is, any Pakistani military folk that are worth their salt, they know that we're not going to be there forever, that we'll probably be tucking tail and getting out of there in a couple of years, even if we put 100,000 troops in now. And so they have to hedge their bets. And the Pakistanis are worried first and foremost about India. And it's really nice to have the Taliban in there to mix it up and to make it difficult. So the Afghans, of course, are going to have to come to terms with the Taliban. And so are we.
Right.
The answer here is to talk to the resistance, the Taliban, and talk to the Iranians, and figure a fairly as comfortable a way out of this dilemma as we can. And it's just the opposite. When people talk about sending more troops in, the presence of foreign troops is the most important element driving the insurgents, driving the Taliban. So what we need to do is come to our senses. I asked a friend of mine just today, Pat Lang, who is one of the veteran intelligence professionals for Sanity. He was pretty much number two in DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. I asked him, you know, did anyone talk to you about planning for Afghanistan? Well, guess what? No, they talked to each other. You know, the sainted or the anointed Petraeus, Petraeus ex machina, you know, he wears his medals and he says in out of one corner of his mouth, you know, there's be no military solution here. And then out of the other side of his mouth, he says, yes, send more troops, send more troops. It's just like the surge. It's not going to work. What really hurts me is that lots of people are going to die. Not only U.S. troops, but Afghans as well,
right,
which is already the case.
And there are people, too, like the Iraqis and like our soldiers and like our children. The Afghanistani people are also human beings.
Exactly. Now, if you talk strategically, Pakistan dwarfs in significance all the surrounding countries. Why? Well, one reason, simple reason, is it's got 173 million people. That's more than Iran, Iraq, and Afghanistan put together. It's actually 50 million more than those three put together. And, of course, the clincher is the Pakistanis have nuclear weapons, about 100 of them.
Right, that we helped them with. Well, another thing is our incursions over the Pakistan border is destabilizing that government.
Yeah, you know, not only that, but, you know, we kick down doors and so forth. Pakistan's prime minister said last year, quote, if America wants to see itself clean of terrorists, we also want to see our villages and towns that should not be bombed and our homes should not be invaded. Just makes good sense. You don't do this if you want to win hearts and minds, and it's the only way to prevail in an insurgency is to get the people on your side by doing things for the people, not in
a, right. Well, you know, I don't think our empire is worried about winning hearts and minds. I sent you that video about Plan Mexico, about our part in the drug wars in Mexico and how our military-industrial complex feels like they have to be involved in it now because they said it's for our, you know, national security. How in Afghanistan, of course, opium production is way up and most of that opium finds its way to the United States. And, you know, that's billions of dollars industry. So, you know, I think that we're not worried about winning hearts and minds, at least not the robber class who seemingly run the empire, but they're worried about profit and about keeping these areas destabilized. So we have probably about, you know, 8 or so minutes left, and your veteran intelligent professionals for sanity, you're working on something about Chaz Freeman, and I really want to hear your take on this because it's super interesting and it has to do with that region, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, it has to do with the whole Middle East and the, you know, attendant problems. Make a long story short, we have this fellow Chaz Freeman, incredibly bright diplomat, high official. Not only is he incredibly knowledgeable about what's going on in the world, but he speaks the most difficult languages, Chinese. He interpreted for Nixon on his first visit with Zhou Enlai, and he learned it at the Foreign Service Institute. You know, it's not like he grew up in China, and he studied Arabic at Monterey and became our ambassador to Saudi Arabia, fluent in Arabic. Mm-hmm. There's a story, a true story, that he got a little bored studying Arabic, so he studied yet another language on the side.
Uh-huh.
Anyhow, he's outspoken, and he has his own views, and he speaks very freely about the Middle East. And he said, look, you know, it doesn't make any sense for us to be one-sidedly supporting Israel when the whole place is going down the tubes. It's unconscionable what the Israelis have been doing, and our policy used to be one of balance between Israelis and Palestinians. It no longer is. We have to fix that. He said that out loud, which, you know, is not usually done in polite conversation in Washington.
Did he have something to say about the American-Israeli Political Affairs Committee also?
Well, he didn't until they removed him.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was he was appointed to chair National Intelligence Estimates. Okay, the head of the National Intelligence Council does that, and he was given that job. I mean, he wasn't nominated for it. He was appointed in it
right, by
the director of National Intelligence, Admiral Blair. So what happened to him was he was dislodged from that. This is not a person who needs Senate confirmation. This is way down deep in the ranks. I've never seen it before, and I've been around here 45 years. And it was unconscionable. It was really, really unique. And what they did was they cited his statements about Israel, people like Chuck Schumer and other people in AIPAC,
mm-hmm.
especially Steve Rosen. Now, Steve Rosen was the guy who led the charge, okay? Now,
I don't know who Steve Rosen is.
Yeah,
maybe you can tell me and my listeners who that
sure.
is.
Sure. Steve Rosen is one of the highest officials in AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And just by the way, Cindy, he's under indictment. He has been indicted under the espionage law
for
spying for
Israel. Right.
So
now
here's
I
the
know
guy
he
that
is.
Leads the charge. Okay, leads the charge against Freeman. Schumer comes in. He says Freeman's statements on Israel are beyond the pale. I made this argument to the White House, and I'm very glad the White House finally believed me. So what happens to Freeman is he's out in his ear because the president wouldn't stand up for his own appointment. His own appointment of Chaz Freeman. Now, Freeman is not the kind of guy who will, you know, he's not a shrinking violet. So as he goes out, he says exactly what happened to him.
Uh-huh.
He says it's really hard when the United States of America can't run its own foreign policy without deferring to the needs of the Israel lobby and the folks in the Likudnik part of the extremist right in Israel. Now, that's the first time anybody did that. And even that wended its way into the New York Times, the Washington Post. And so at an end is Steve Rosen's favorite expression, the lobbyists flourish in the dark, you know. They don't stand well the light of day. It's out in the open now, mm-hmm. and there is a wide controversy, an approvable thing. AIPAC is saying, we didn't say anything. Well, everyone knows Steve Rosen and everybody else did this because some of their cohorts bragged about it. So it may be a Pyrrhic victory for AIPAC because of that. Everyone sees the lobby for what it is. And maybe next time, or this time, when Netanyahu takes over as prime minister in Israel, people will see that Israel's interests are not always identical to ours, and that we have to be very, very careful of people like Netanyahu, who would dearly love to get us involved in a war with Iran.
Iran, right. Well, I you know, I know you were just being ironic, but oftentimes Israel's interests are dangerous to the United States, and now we're mired in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it doesn't seem like there's going to be any way out soon. But to me, this Chaz Freeman thing, you called it L'Affaire Chaz Freeman, is almost like the witch hunts, or I'm sorry, I apologize to my Wicca friends, but it seems like during the 50s when McCarthy was going after suspected communists, now we're going to go after people who might not be raging Zionists and remove them from government?
Well, that's what happened. As I say, when people come to their senses, as many have now, and saw, you know, this sort of bald exercise of power, I think they're going to realize that what George Washington, our first president, warned us against, namely a, quote, passionate attachment, end quote, of one country to the perceived objectives of another,
right.
That this really is a very baleful influence on our foreign policy. And indeed, Chaz Freeman used that expression in his parting shot, saying, you know, this is really strange. We have a passionate attachment to a country like Israel, and we give them a veto on the appointment of people like me to high positions in our government.
Well, that's incredible. And not only, you know, something like that happens, but, you know, when you said veto, many times the U.S. uses our veto in the U.N. Security Council to, you know, stop any kind of sanctions against Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's usually us in the Security Council, and when there's a general vote, of course, the Israelis and a handful of others, vote with Israel. But what's happening now, and I was over there just two summers ago, what's happening now in the West Bank and in Gaza, of course, is equivalent to the worst pogroms that the Jews themselves experienced
right. In
Europe in the late 18th and 19th centuries.
Well, we've been very outspoken against that here on the Soapbox, and it's incredible, like you said, how the perceptions have changed, or how people's perceptions have changed, because I've gotten very little pushback about, you know, being anti-Semitic or whatever, because people are realizing that, you know, Israel is the aggressor and Israel is the occupier. And no matter what the mainstream media wants everybody to think, that, oh, poor Israel, a lot of people aren't buying that anymore, thank goodness. So, you know, hopefully we're, you know, have more sanity like you guys have here in the working class, or here in the movement. I see a lot of positive developments that way.
Yeah, and among the Jewish community in this country, there are very strong streams that are against what AIPAC has stood for.
Absolutely.
J Street now is gathering momentum. This is a recently founded movement.
Right.
And most people of Jewish heritage voted for Barack Obama. And so it's really kind of, you have to be careful when you talk about the lobby, when you talk about AIPAC. It's incredibly wealthy, it's incredibly powerful and effective, but it only represents a minority of the Jewish people in this country.
Right, and of course, Jewish Voices for Peace, Tikkun, Rabbi Arthur Lerner have been very outspoken about against what they're or what Israel is doing to the Palestinian people. Well, Ray, it was great talking to you. Is there any way my listeners can get a hold of you if they have any questions?
Sure. Actually, they can just email me. It's rrmcgovern@aol.com. So just two R's before McGovern and then AOL.com.
Well, thanks, my friend, for being on. And we haven't been arrested together for a while, so I'll have to.
I was just going to say that.
I know.
Your place or my place?
What's up with that? I don't think it matters, any place. So
you're going to come to Washington sometime soon, I hope.
I don't have any plans, but if I do, I'll let you know so we can get into some mischief together again. Great, Ray. Thank you. I'll talk to you later.
Bye now.
You're listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. When we come back, you'll be hearing my speech from Fresno. Stay tuned.
First, they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. If you would like to keep your voice on the air, and you feel this show is important, please contribute now. Go to www.cindysheehanssoapbox.com. That's CindySheehanssoapbox.com. The phone is 562-912-5860. That number again is 562-912-5860. Please help us keep this show on the air. Your generous contribution is appreciated. I do have my Peace Fresno shirt on that I got last time I was here, and I wear it a lot. It's not one that I just folded up and put it in a box somewhere. I do wear it a lot out. A lot of people have asked me, why are you going to Fresno? You gonna go buy some raisins? And you know, I say, no, Fresno has an amazing peace community. And you would never know it, but it has an amazing progressive community in Fresno, too. So, and I'm just honored. I'm honored to be here again with you to energize each other, to get some ideas from each other, to how do we keep doing this? How do we keep doing this? You know, this is the sixth year. We're going into the seventh year. And it'll be 8 years in October that we invaded Afghanistan. And, you know, we have to blame the weather. I think this is an awesome turnout for it being a practical, storm. I did drive through some storms on the way here, and I was really iffy about it. But I made it. I think there's a lot of protest fatigue happening. We have marched thousands of miles. We've signed so many petitions. We've called Congress till our fingers bled. I'm just using hyperbole. I don't think anybody's fingers really bled. Some of us even ran for Congress to try and make a difference. But you know, we had a change in regime in November, and that's not even helping. You know, President Obama has said, and, you know, if you're an Obama supporter or not an Obama supporter, I myself voted for Cynthia McKinney. Yay, Cynthia! His foreign policy is abominable.
You know, he is only following the Bush status of force agreement in Iraq that Bush negotiated before he left office with the Maliki government. Even his slow 16-month withdrawal has been extended, and troops are never going to come home from Iraq. You know, everybody, when McCain said that the troops would be in Iraq for 100 years, he wasn't kidding. You know, even Obama is just bringing out what he calls combat troops. I'm moving back here. I really don't want to get electrocuted. And he's increasing or surging Afghanistan, sending more troops there. You don't know how many people email me, say, Cindy, you have to tell the president not to send more troops to Afghanistan. And I'm like, why are you emailing me? Presidents never listen to me. Well, Obama has to know that that's going to be a disaster. Obama knows it's going to be a disaster. Anybody that has ever gone into Afghanistan has limped out with their empire crumbled. And I think the U.S. empire needs to crumble. I'm all for that. But it should not have to crumble on the heads of the Afghan people or our soldiers or the families of the soldiers. And not only is our empire, our military empire crumbling, so is our economic empire. And that's affecting each and every one of us. It's not affecting the AIG executives. It's not affecting the Wall Street robber barons. It's affecting us. It's not affecting Congress. They gave themselves a raise. Congress has 110% health insurance. They're covered 110%. How come we can't get that kind of health insurance? They're our employees. So, what would be a better way to have the empire crumble besides it crumbling on innocent people? That would be for President Barack Obama to courageously get up and say, today, I am declaring an end to the war on terror. I am saying that we have, I don't even care if he wants to say we won. He can say, I'm declaring victory, we won, we're bringing our troops home. And not only that, but we are going to close most of the 775 bases we have around the world. And we're going to reduce our military to a size that's for defensive purposes only, not for the size that can spread corporate imperialism around the world. And we're going to use that money we're going to save on the empire, and we're going to give everybody who wants to go to college a free education, not a $2,500 a year tax credit. That my daughter goes to San Francisco State. That would only pay for a third of her education. And you know what? To get it, she's going to have to do community service. Now, I'm all for community service, but why do the kids of the robbed class have to do it to not even get their education paid for? But the robber class, they can afford to send their kids to Yale and Harvard and Stanford and USC. I went to UCLA, so I don't even know why anybody would want to go to USC. But they don't have to do community service. They should do community service, and our kids should do too, but you shouldn't hold our kids' education hostage to that. Our kids have the right to go to college too. Our kids have that as a basic human right for education. You know what? Many countries have free university education. Cuba has free university education. Cuba has free health care for everybody who lives there. Everybody in Cuba has a roof over their heads. It might not be a mansion, but it's a roof, and they can keep themselves dry, which is relevant today. And he could say, and we're going to use some of the money we're saving on empire to have not affordable health care, because I'm sorry, but that, for the kids in the audience, excuse my French, but that's bullshit. We should all get single-payer health care, we should be covered 110%. If we go to the doctor, they should pay for our gas. You know, we should be covered 110% like they are in many civilized countries around the world. But no, he's going to give health care tax credits too. What about people who don't pay taxes? What about very indigent people? How are they going to get themselves covered for education and health care when the empire is now starting to reduce benefits to people, reduce social services? And that angers me almost more than anything. We can save money in the VA system because everybody would have education and health care. People wouldn't be like my son and join the military to get a university education. But how can you run an empire if you don't have cannon fodder? So that's what we in the peace movement have to do in this sixth anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. And like Dan said, we can't forget on October 7th, the eighth anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan. That's an illegal and immoral war, too. That's not a smart war. Obama says he's just against dumb wars. All wars are dumb. And we have to keep telling him that. All wars are dumb, Mr. President. We give you the job to defend America, not to make America less safe. We gave you the job to protect us, not to kill innocent people or torture innocent people to protect us. That doesn't protect us. That, in fact, compromises our safety. So in the sixth anniversary of the war, many people predicted we'd be here today. We'd be here in an economy that is crumbling. How can you constantly have a military empire budget without it hurting people in the empire? How can you have that without the economy collapsing? So it's very sinister, I think. It's very sinister that people 6 months ago that never would have thought of joining the military are now joining the military because they can't find a job. They have to get their teeth fixed. They have to have health care, and they think they're going to get education. And many people bought into the robber class myth. We only have two classes in this country, or two divisions, robber class and robbed class. Well, a robber class myth, where was I going? There was some robber class myth that I was going to talk about. You guys can actually buy my book, and you can find out what those robber class myths are. My book's called Myth America. You get it? Myth America instead of Miss America. It's the 10 greatest myths of the robber class and a case for revolution. So, one of the biggest robber class myths is that it is noble to die in a war for the robber class. And if you support Obama or don't support Obama, Obama is not a peace president. Obama is, just another warmonger for the robber class. But many people, especially our children of color, are thinking that it'll be better to die for Obama than it was to die for George Bush. Well, you know what? You're dead. No matter who the president is, you're dead. And so kids are joining the military. Even a dear friend of mine who spent weeks with me after my son was killed because he was Casey's best friend. He's joining the military and we can't figure it out. He said, because I can't find a job and they're promising me this bonus and they're promising me I can play softball. But we're like, Kenny, recruiters lie. You're being lied to. They lie to Casey. But when they don't have any other alternative, they want to believe that. They want to believe that they're going to get a $20,000 bonus when it's only going to be a few thousand at the end. Or none. Exactly. Recruiters are still telling them, we won't send you to combat. And as soon as they graduate from boot camp, where do they go first? To combat. A recruiter told Casey he'd never see combat. He was killed in combat 5 days after he got to Iraq. So the best thing we can do here in Fresno is to put ourselves between our children and the military. Put ourselves between our children and the robber class. Because, you know, the robber class will never send their own children to fight and die. And the robber class will never use their own money to pay for the wars. They want us to finance their wars, and they want us to give our children so they can be killed in their wars so they can profit. And we can never, ever give up. If we're tired of war, if we're tired of protesting, if we're tired of coming out here, rain or shine, we still have to keep moving. We cannot give up. And we have to move through our disappointment. We have to move through our fatigue. We have to move through our anger. I was telling the grannies, I'm a granny now. I have a 10-month-old grandson. And I have one on the way. But I'm beyond raging. Whatever that is above raging, I'm raging, I'm pissed off, I'm words that I can't say on a microphone when there's kids here. But that's the way we all have to be. You know, we have to use that. Anger, it can be a bad emotion, but it could also be a positive emotion. If you channel it to activism, and if you channel it to total righteous causes, peace is a righteous cause to be angry about. Not having peace is what we should be angry about. That peace is somehow used. Yo, they're just hippies. They're just peace activists. We don't have to pay attention to them. Like, somehow it's wrong for us not to want people to get killed. So use that anger and channel it to save the lives of our children. And if we save the lives of our children, then we'll save the lives of the children of Iraq, the children of Gaza, the children of Afghanistan, the children of Pakistan, the children of Iran, the children of even Venezuela, Cuba. The empire doesn't stop. The empire doesn't quit. But what we have to say is we are not citizens of the empire. We're citizens of humanity. And we're going to separate ourselves out of the empire and go forward with this rage that I hope we all feel. And if, like that bumper sticker says, if you're not angry, what's wrong with you? If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. And we need to also know that the economy is a horrible, horrible mess right now. But we cannot separate the economic cost of war from the human cost of war. And we have to keep making those connections and say, until we end this military and industrial and corporate empire, we're not going to have prosperity in our country. And, you know, many people have said the chickens are coming home to roost. And they are. You know, we've had this false sense of prosperity for decades. And it's only false, and now it's collapsing on us. So seriously, read my book, because not only do I expose the myths, but I give us solutions on how to separate ourselves from the robber class, because I've only been doing this for 5 years, and I honor people who have been doing it for much longer. But we aren't making much dent in the robber class. They have all the tools. They have all the money. They have the military. They have the media. So they have the tools to keep us bought into their system. So what we have to do is work together to create our own system, to not be the robbed class system, not to be the robbed class, but to be the independent class, to be the class where we'll do organic gardening. Well, where we'll park our cars. We'll turn off our TVs. We'll work as a community to get through these hard times. Because we cannot rely on credit to get us through. Because you know what? You always have to pay. You know? Obama says credit's the lifeblood of our economy. That's not true. Credit is a stranglehold on our economy. And so until we work together to get ourselves through this, we're not going to get through it. And we are way more than the robber class. So if we want a peaceful revolution of values, like Martin Luther King Jr. said, then we cannot isolate ourselves and pretend like we're in this all alone. We're in it all together, and we can't let phony divisions of Democrat, Republican, Green, Independent, Peace and Freedom, you know, what, communist, socialist, whatever, we can't let those things divide us. We can't let black, white, brown, yellow, orange, whatever divide us. We can't let male, female divide us. Because, you know, those are all malleable. We can change the color of our skin. Michael Jackson did it. We can change our sex, our gender. Many people have done it. We can change our, it's real easy to change your political party. Just walk over there. They have forms. So all those divisions that they want to separate us by, we should tell the robber class we're not buying into that myth anymore. You know, we're all members. We're all this planet. We're all on this planet together. And the most devious thing they want to separate us by is by Mexicans, Americans, Canadians, Iraqi, Afghan, Pakistani. And those are just these false lines drawn on a map by dead white guys a long time ago that says, if you live past that line, you're my enemy. So what we are all connected, not just Americans, but we're connected with every person on this earth. And when America is healthy and when Americans are healthy, the rest of the world's healthy too. So again, go to my website, CindySheehanSoapbox.com. This has not just been a giant infomercial for my book, but this is, I think, exactly the revolution that we need, because we're not going to change the system without a revolution. So thank you so much. I adore you. Thank you. See? Even the universe agrees. It got sunny.
Thanks for listening this week, and please don't forget to spread the word about our soapbox. That is your soapbox action today, is send the link to these shows to everybody that you can think of. Let's start spreading the word. And also, you can follow me on Twitter. On Twitter, I'm Cindy_Sheehan. I'm on Facebook. I think I'm just Cindy Sheehan on Facebook. On MySpace, I'm Cindy Sheehan for Congress 2010. And you can follow me on Blogspot. It's CindySheehanSoapbox.blogspot.com. And don't forget to send me your rants and your Ask Cindy questions to Cindy at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. We really want to build this internet community for revolution to overthrow the systems of the robber class. I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser. This is Cindy Sheehan, always speaking the power of the people to the greed of power. Talk to you soon.